I'm Dr. Leif Tappanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Well, today our guest is Rich Hatfield, Senior Endangered Species Conservation Biologist with the Xerces Society. Today we'll be talking about bumblebees and how their declining numbers are affecting pollination of plants in Idaho.
This is another great episode. I've been slowly for the last year and a half trying to convert my front yard into a bumblebee garden. And I'm not using any chemicals, so you're trying to let this grass die on its own and throw all natives. And I can tell you my neighbors are getting a little impatient.
They're getting impatient. They want to see some either lots of flowers or something. You're growing dandelions?
We've got dandelions right now and weeds.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
Yes. That sounds exciting.
Yes, it is.
Hey, if the insects are happy, then we're happy, right?
Absolutely. All right, we got to do some nature news today.
Let's do that.
Another one of these topics that's near and dear to my heart, Leif. Researchers from the University in Amsterdam have found out that colonies of seals and penguins in Antarctica can influence biodiversity with more than 1,000 meters away with their poop.
Right on.
Yep. So again, this is a subject that I really love to talk about.
That's like half a mile away. Okay.
That is a half a mile away, and it's just with their poop.
Tell me more.
The poop produced by these critters partially evaporates as ammonia. And then the wind will blow the ammonia inland, which makes its way into the soil and provides nitrogen for primary producers. And as a result of this, this enrichment produces a thriving community of lichens and moss. And the amount of lichens and moss produces, just an insanely number of invertebrates. Just to kind of put it in perspective, invertebrates in our grasslands in the U.S. or Europe can support 50 to 100,000 invertebrates per square meter.
Okay.
This enriched soil in the Antarctic can support over 1 million small invertebrates per square meter.
Wow. So it's ten times more.
Tenfold, right. Wow. And we're talking about the Antarctic where the environment is extreme.
Right.
You know, we've got cold. It's basically a cold desert. There's not very much precipitation, but it's so cold. So when you do get precipitation, it just stays. It doesn't go away. And what these scientists have found is that these invertebrate populations are more affected by the number of animals present, the amount of poo that's produced, than any other type of environmental factor, whether it's temperature, moisture, etc. So the animals and their poo have the greatest effect on animal biodiversity in the Antarctic.
That's a surprising result, right?
Yes, it is.
Interesting. Again, fascinated by the things you bring in. Thanks so much, Peter.
You bet.
Well, trivia time here. Today we're going to be talking about bumblebees, and our question is related to that, of course. So our question that we'll answer later, what is the number of bumblebee species in North America? Well, we'll come back to that, and along with a whole bunch of really interesting topics on pollinators when we come back from our break.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
And we're back. We want to welcome our guest today, Rich Hatfield. He's the Senior Endangered Species Conservation Biologist with Xerces Society. Thanks for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, so bumblebees is your specialty. I think we're all familiar with bumblebees. They're a pretty large bee that flies around, and they like flowers. I understand that much. Can you tell us a little bit about bumblebees in North America or in the United States, and a little bit about their lives? What do they do? That maybe
sure
we're not aware of.
Yeah. Should I avoid answering your trivia question at this point?
You can avoid it at the moment. Yeah, sure.
I'll avoid it. Okay. All right. So we have X number of species in North America. The bulk of the diversity or biodiversity is based in the Pacific Northwest, actually, where we have between 20 and 30 species in that neighborhood. And, you know, one of the challenges that I deal with sort of on a daily basis is that what most people know and understand about bees is based on the European honeybee, which is a non-native species. And it's really kind of weird in the bee world as well. You know, there are close to 20,000 species of bees worldwide, and only five of them, really, or around five of them, make appreciable amounts of honey, or what we think of as honeybees. And, you know, they live in these enormous colonies that just is sort of outside the realm of what happens with our native bees. And so, you know, bumblebees and honeybee colonies can last several years, you know, 7 to 10 years in a healthy colony. But all bumblebees only live for a single year. So one queen sort of emerges in the spring, and she finds a place to build a nest, which is going on all over our region this time of year. And then once she founds a nest, you know, she starts bringing in resources and lays eggs. And one of the cool things about bees in general, but bumblebees as well, is that their only source of protein is pollen. So they're actually intentionally collecting pollen and moving around the landscape, which is different than pretty much every other animal out there that we consider a pollinator. Bees are the only ones that are doing that intentionally, and that's what makes them such great pollinators. But they're bringing that pollen back to their nest to then lay their eggs on it, and their larvae eat pollen. It's really their only food. They go through several instars and then actually go through complete metamorphosis, just like a caterpillar to a butterfly, and become a winged adult. And they spend a few weeks as a worker, a winged adult, sort of bringing resources back to the nest and helping the nest get bigger. And then towards the end of the season, you know, towards late summer or fall, the colony sort of switches to producing the reproductive members of the colony, which are the kind of new queens and gynes that sort of disperse in the landscape and mate, and then the queen, you know, fattens up, gets enough resources to find a place to overwinter, and she'll do that at a different place from where the nest was. And then the rest of the colony dies, and she starts again the following spring.
Their life cycle is so cool, and you think about it's short in the general scheme of our lives. It's extremely short in geological time. And, you know, I think people kind of need to understand, especially if they start looking into bumblebee conservation, there's multiple aspects of it. It's just not a matter of having flowers in their yard. You got to understand their life cycle and their life history as you are looking at, you know, trying to help out these bumblebees.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And it's funny, while their life cycle is short compared to us, it's actually fairly long for an invertebrate, right? Most invertebrates might spend a couple of weeks as a winged adult or as an adult when that's their chance to sort of mate and be done with it. And then, you know, they move on in their evolutionary lives. But bumblebees, you know, they have this whole period of time where the queen is really the reproductive unit. So even in the middle of summer, when we might see 500 workers in a colony, that colony actually hasn't reproduced yet until the fall, when those new queens are mated and in the ground. And so, you know, looking from a management perspective or from a habitat perspective, like that colony needs flowering resources and safe habitat, you know, from early spring through fall, just to produce the reproductive members of the colony. But then they also need a safe place to overwinter, you know, which is different from that. So yeah, there are all these components to habitat. It's more than just putting flowers on the landscape. You're right.
Do they have specific flower choices or preferences?
Bumblebees are, for the most part, generalists. You know, they'll visit whatever's most abundant on the landscape, sort of at a gross scale. It is interesting that all bumblebees have what we call different length tongues. So their tongues are sort of millimeters different, and the length of their tongue somewhat correlates with their food choices. So bumblebees with longer tongues tend to visit flowers that have longer corolla tubes, and bumblebees with shorter tongues tend to visit flowers with shorter or no corolla tubes. And so that's one of the reasons that we encourage people just to, at any time of year, to have a diversity of flowers on the landscape. So, you know, while those dandelions are great for now, some of the other weeds that you have in your yard that you were talking about at the beginning are important so that we can support, you know, not just the common species, but we want to have food out there that's supporting all of the different species on the landscape.
Yeah, you know, I'm working on basically 9 native flowers, and I'm trying to get where I can get 3 that bloom in the spring, 3 in the fall, and 3 in the summer. So, yeah.
Are there color choices that bees are attracted to more than others?
Yeah. Yeah, they're actually visual scale is different than humans. We sort of see the Roy G. Biv rainbow that people are familiar with. But bumblebees actually, they're stopped short of red. So they don't see red at all. But they do see ultraviolet. So most bees prefer sort of yellow and purple flowers. Those tend to be their preferences. There are some flowers that actually have ultraviolet sort of landing patterns on them that you and I can't see with our eyes, but, you know, with specialized photography, we can see those patterns, and they sometimes those ultraviolet patterns will guide bees into red flowers or other colors of flowers as well. But yeah, yellow and purple seem to be the ones that bumblebees prefer.
So a real basic question here, there are many different kinds of bees, and there are many, I guess, flying insects that maybe people get confused with bees or some other kind of wasp or hornet or maybe a flying insect. Could you describe how bumblebees in particular distinguish themselves, how you'd visually tell them apart from something else?
There's not too much that you're going to confuse a bumblebee for. I think, you know, when you opened the show, you sort of just talked about everybody sort of knows what a bumblebee is, and I think that's true. You know, they're these large black and yellow creatures that are sort of universally hairy. Their whole bodies have, you know, hairs all over them, and they're usually black and yellow, but sometimes have some red or orange or white on them. And they're fairly large bodied. You know, they're bigger than most other flying insects. You can often hear them before you see them.
Right.
Which is another indicator as well.
They're not overly aggressive either, right? If they have to protect their nest, they will. But for the most part, you let them be, they're not like a wasp who just decides to attack for the sake of attacking.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I spend hundreds of hours a year watching, you know, bumblebees on flowers, and you can get your nose right up to them, or even, I mean, I'm not going to necessarily recommend that you do this, but you can even pet them while they're on flowers, and you know, no harm is going to come for you. They've got work to do, and they're busy trying to do it, and you know, you're sort of the least of their concerns. So yeah, everybody always asks questions about getting stung, but with most native bees, it's a non-factor. They certainly can sting you, but it's really rare. It's really rare. They're very gentle, kind of wonderful creatures.
In the natural system, what are the predators that they worry about?
That's a good question. I think crab spiders are probably a big one, sort of at an individual level. At a colony level, like, I would imagine there's some larger mammals that may occasionally dig up a nest for, you know, there's lots of larvae in there, and that's a lot of good protein. So things like a badger or, you know, maybe a bear might do that. But I think their nests are pretty hard to find. So I would imagine there's some smaller wasp parasites that are likely doing a fair job predating, and ants as well. So things like that.
So if we're not really looking at predators, what's the biggest factor for these declines in bumblebees?
It's probably food. You know, we've changed the land. We've done such a good job changing the landscape over the last 100 years, mostly by, you know, converting what were once really solid food opportunities for them into farm fields and into, you know, houses and things like that to make the world a better place to live for humans, at least for the short term. Longer term, you know, I have some questions about that. You know, and meanwhile, sort of while we've been reducing the amount of food out there, I think we're also reducing the quality of food that's out there. Well, we've got a lot more invasive species in our natural lands, invasive plant species. You know, we've started using highly toxic chemicals at really high rates, you know, throughout the landscape. And then, of course, we're also inducing climate change at the same time. And we're throwing all of these factors at bees. And at the same time, you know, they're trying to go about their business of just surviving at a base level. And then, you know, there's another interesting issue that's going on in bumblebees. The more I become a conservation biologist, the more I realize I probably should have studied epidemiology. But there are a lot of disease issues as well. The diseases are being spread likely from managed bees, including commercial bumblebees and honeybees. And they're being transmitted to our wild bees. And, you know, in some cases, they don't have the immunity to deal with those diseases or the levels of those diseases that they're being exposed to. So there's a lot going on. it's not pretty in some ways.
So one of the one of the problems that people are having with like the honeybees is that colony disorder. Are bumblebees running into that same issue too?
No, I think is the short answer to it. I mean, I don't really know what colony collapse disorder is, right? We don't have an answer for what's causing that. But I don't think we're seeing, it's hard to answer, I guess, because in some ways we just can't monitor bumblebees in the same way we can honeybees, right? Honeybees live in boxes and we know where their nests are and we can move them around and count them and monitor them. And, you know, that's just not true for our native bees. It's hard, their populations are hard to monitor. But, you know, in the mid-1990s, we did have several species that went from being quite common to, you know, in some cases, potentially extinct. We had a species in Northern California and Southern Oregon that hasn't been seen since 2006 and used to be fairly common, you know. So we did have some event that happened, but I don't see any evidence that event is annual or that it's continuing at, you know, those distinct levels. It seems like something happened, you know, and we're trying to recover from that now, given all those factors that we've talked about.
Yeah, I'm interested. How do you go about studying this kind of an animal like you said that doesn't return to a comb the way a honeybee population might? So how do you track them and learn more about potential changes in their numbers or species counts?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard is the short answer. We do our best, but for most invertebrates, like, we're just lacking baseline information. We don't know where they live. We don't know, you know, what habitats are important. We don't know where they nest. We don't know where they're overwintering, like, with specific detail. You know, we have some records from the 50s where excellent biologists went out and described the things they found, but, you know, we don't have a lot of that. So at a very basic level, we're still trying to just collect baseline information, like what animals are living where, what habitats are they associated with. So we're way behind the game that, you know, sort of mammal biologists and bird biologists are at. We just don't have that baseline information. So we're trying to collect it and figure out how to do it better, so that we can monitor these things through time. But without sort of the baseline information, it's hard to have anything to compare it to. So that's kind of where we are.
So
it's better with bumblebees than it is the other, you know, 3,500 species in North America of bees. You know, we know hardly anything about them.
Is there anything that we can do as citizens, non-research, non-scientific members of the community to help with this baseline information?
Yeah, there is. I mean, we're especially right now in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, we're running a project called the Pacific Northwest Bumblebee Atlas, and we're currently recruiting community scientists to spread out in the landscape and sort of adopt a piece of the Northwest and go out and actually sample bumblebees. And one of the cool things about bumblebees versus a lot of other bees is you don't need to destructively sample bumblebees to identify them usually. So we've got a protocol where people capture bumblebees and actually put them on ice, which sort of puts them in a state of torpor, and then they can take high quality photos that allows experts to identify the species. And you know, they submit that data to us, and we're able to find out what their host sites were and where they were found. And we're going to use all of that information eventually to get the baseline information. But then we'll also know a lot more about which plants are important and which habitats are important. So then we can go back to land managers in Idaho and Washington and say, hey, you ought to be planting these plants. Or we can say the same thing to homeowners. You ought to be planting these plants in your yard. These are really important for some of our rare species, and can you help us support them? So that's kind of that's the current ask right now for us in the Northwest.
If we ask our listeners to help out with this project, you referred to it as the Pacific Northwest, is that Bumblebee Atlas?
Yeah, that's right.
And so there's a website that we could direct our listeners to off our website, to pnwbumblebeeatlas.org. That's all one big long word, right? pnwbumblebeeatlas.org. And what would they find there? What's the interface like to allow them to capture that information? You described that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's mostly just a big pile of resources organized in different ways. But one of the first places to start, I think there's a sort of a get involved tab at the top. And there, if you sort of scroll down to adopt a grid cell, it'll bring up a map. And it's kind of a live interactive map, which shows the grids that we've created and where we've already collected data and where we really still need people to get out and do some samples for us. And, then they can sort of, if they were so inclined, they could adopt one of those grid cells and sort of make it their own spot. And sort of, we're asking people to do that and then plan a bumblebee watching adventure and go out and find a place to conduct some surveys for us and then submit their data. And the resources on how to do all that are sort of organized in, I think, what makes sense to me. Hopefully it does to other people as well. But it's a pretty rich website with a lot of different resources and links and videos, too. We have sort of a lot of how-to videos. There's also a link to, we're doing a bunch of trainings throughout the region. I'm going to be in Spokane next weekend, and there's an event in Portland in a couple weeks after that. We did one in Idaho Falls a few weeks ago. So there's also links to those events and things like that on the webpage.
So does the webpage even include what types of flowers and vegetation someone should start looking at and planting and potentially a guide to converting their yard into a bumblebee garden?
Yeah, not so much there. So the organization I work for, the Xerces Society, we do have a website that has all kinds of plant lists and resources for people to create habitat. We even wrote a book called Attracting Native Pollinators, which is sort of an A to Z guide about how to convert any landscape into pollinator-friendly habitat. So Xerces.org is our website, and there's lots of resources there where you can find. You can go to our resource center, and that's where you'll find the plant lists and, how to collect your own wildflower seed if you want to, how to do organic prep. Like, you could learn how to convert your lawn a little bit faster. there's maybe Mr. Neighbor's a little happier.
Well, at this point, I'm kind of like, yeah, we'll go the slow path.
That's all right. We all want to be the biologist that returns wolves to Yellowstone, but sometimes just letting nature take its course is the right way to go. I'm with you there.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of ways, I think, that citizens can get involved. And so we've outlined a few of them. I really like this idea of having a summer project, for example, where you could go out with the kids or something like that and make observations that are really providing information and data that's high quality data that, that can help on these conservation efforts. Again, the pollinators in our area are really important for maintaining the plant species that we have. And as well as, maintaining their own numbers and species for the biodiversity that we enjoy in this area.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. 85% of the flowering plants in the world require a pollinator, and usually that pollinator is a bee. And, that's important for flower diversity, but, the majority of mammals on the planet and birds, their diet is berries, fruits, nuts, seeds, and roots. And we wouldn't have those products without the flower diversity. So you're right, the pollinators are, indirectly feeding a lot of the planet, no question.
They're basically the first step in our whole food pyramid.
Yeah, sort of post photosynthesis, they are the first step, yeah.
Yep.
Fantastic. Yep. I want to thank you, Rich. And at the beginning of the show, we started off with this trivia question that we danced around for the last 20 minutes. So could you help us? What is the number of bumblebee species in North America currently?
Well, unfortunately, it's one of these things where it kind of depends on who you talk to, but 46 is a good number. 46 is a good number. There are some arguments about whether there are animals that are different species or the same species, but 46 is a good number. We'll go with that one.
Yeah, that's a surprisingly large number, I think. Certainly it is to me. When I'm just seeing them flying around, a bumblebee is a bumblebee, right? But, of course, there's much more to it than that.
Yeah, there is, for sure.
All right. We want to thank you, Rich, for joining us today. Rich Hatfield, Senior Endangered Species Conservation Biologist with the Xerces Society. And to learn more about his work, please visit pnwbumblebeeatlas.org and xerces.org. Shows are recorded here at the studios of KISU Pocatello. Visit us at kisu.org for questions, comments, and audio for all our programs. Our theme music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. And please remember to get outside and enjoy the nature of Idaho.